Welcome to Film Roast.
Hey everyone, Hannah here, the co-host of Film Roast, where two overcaffeinated and underqualified friends talk about all things movies. If you like film factoids, lots of sarcasm, and bad impressions, check us out on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Film Roast Show and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/filmroast. Happy roasting!
Hello, everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name is Max.
And I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about Rachel Carson.
Ooh, I love her. And I'm going to be talking to you about Zhao Xijing.
Good work on that name. So Rachel Carson is, to our current political system and the current American life, one of the most influential people, scientists, to have graced the American public sphere. So she's born May 27th, 1907, on a family farm near Springdale, Pennsylvania, to parents Maria Fraser and Robert Warden Carson, who was a door-to-door salesman at the time.
Oh, wow.
She grew up wanting to be a writer, and she actually started writing at 8, with her first publication coming in the St. Nicholas magazine at the age of 10.
Whoa.
Which, side note, two other authors who had their first publication in St. Nicholas magazine, William Faulkner and F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Small fish.
Just very small.
Very minimal. We shouldn't really be comparing here.
Not at all. She's not in good company. In 1925, she enrolls at the Pennsylvania College for Women, which today is known as Chatham University, as an English major. But in 1928, she switched to biology. She notes later on that she always knew she wanted to be a writer. She just didn't know what she wanted to write about. And it was when she was in college, she found science and she was like, okay, this is it. This is how I'm going to channel my dreams. So she graduates and then is admitted to Johns Hopkins with graduate student standing in 1928 before she even graduates from the Pennsylvania College for Women, which happens in 1929, so a year later, and she graduates magna cum laude. She starts full-time at Johns Hopkins in 1929 in zoology and genetics, and she suffers some hard financial times. Again, she comes from a very small family on a farm. She has to actually apply for an assistantship after her first year to help pay for her tuition. And this starts a trend that we see that I'll talk about throughout this, where she really did all of these amazing things while under really not the best set of circumstances. Mm. So she graduates in 1932 with her master's in zoology, and she meant to continue for her PhD, but finances and the financial situation for her family actually stopped that, which was actually compounded in 1935 when her father dies, and her mother at the same time is also going through an illness, which is essentially going to consume her life for the rest of her life. Mm. Now, her undergrad mentor, Mary Scott Skinker, steps in and actually urges her to apply for a temporary position at the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries, which today is known as the Fish and Wildlife Service,
right.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And she starts in this temporary position writing radio copy for a 52-episode, each is 7 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And they're it's a show called Romance Under the Waters, which was intended not only to educate the public on fish and things happening under the sea, but also to raise money and to justify the work that the Bureau was doing.
I feel like this is the OG planet Earth.
Literally. So, and what's great about it, in a couple of the different source materials that I was looking at, was that she was not the first person put in charge of this radio series. There had actually been two other people who had been tasked with doing it. None of them could do it. So Rachel comes in, she produces the 52 of these 7-minute little radio series, and her boss is so impressed that at the first opportunity, when a full-time job comes open at the Bureau of Fisheries, he helps her apply for it. She does the civil servant exam, If you don't know, before you get a job in the federal bureaucracy, you have to take a test that basically qualifies you to have a job in the federal bureaucracy. And she outscores every other person
who was
going to take the test. I mean, literally. So in 1936, she becomes the second woman hired by the Bureau of Fisheries for a full-time position as a junior aquatic biologist. Unfortunately, in 1937, her older sister dies, leaving her the sole breadwinner for her mother and her two nieces as well. Ugh. So now she's got this new job and she's the breadwinner for her house as well. She continues to publish for the Bureau of Fisheries, mostly about fish populations. And then in 1937, Atlantic Monthly publishes a series called Underseas, which she'd actually written as a pamphlet for the Bureau of Fisheries. But her boss was like, this is way too good to be a federal publication. You should get this published somehow. So she gets it published in the Atlantic Monthly. Simon & Schuster sees it and says, you should develop this into a book. And in 1941, she publishes it under a new name called Under the Sea Winds, which was very well reviewed, but was it didn't really sell very well.
I feel like the title is not the best. Yeah. Sorry, Rachel.
It's the first in a series of three books about the sea that all have those kinds of names.
Hmm.
Between this, she continues to write articles. She has articles appear in Sun Magazine, Nature, and Collier's. And in 1945, at the Bureau, she's given a writing staff to supervise. In 1949, she becomes the chief editor of publications for the Bureau of Fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1948, she begins a new work about the ocean when the Oxford University Press expresses interest in it.
Ooh.
So 1950, she publishes her first like major publication, which is called The Sea Around Us, which before it actually comes out, chapters appears in Science Digest and the Yale Review. And the chapter that actually appeared in the Yale Review won the American Association for the Advancement of Science's George Westinghouse Science Writing Prize, which is a mouthful of a name for for an award.
Bad name. Back to the bad name situation.
But before the before the book is even published, she has a chapter winning awards for it.
Mm.
The New Yorker serializes 9 different chapters, and then on July 2nd, 1951, she publishes the full book, which then goes on to stay on the New York Times bestseller list for 81 weeks.
Whoa.
81 weeks. And all of this is before she writes her seminal book called Silent Spring, which we're going to get to. Just like Gloria Steinem from a couple weeks ago, quick side note, there's a ton of information on Rachel Carson and a ton of stuff that she did. So during this bitchery episode, we're going to talk about all the before and then up to Silent Spring. And then we'll probably do, I have a couple Lady Bits episodes that we can do about her as well. So look out for those coming soon. So The Sea Around Us stays on the bestseller list for 81 weeks. They republish Under the Sea Wind, which itself now becomes a bestseller.
Oh, man.
The Sea Around Us wins the 1952 National Book Award for Nonfiction. It's awarded the Burroughs Medal, which is for natural science publication. She was awarded 2 honorary doctorates, and she was able to earn enough money that she retired from the Bureau of Fish and Wildlife Services. So between 1953 and 1962, she continues to write and research, again, a ton of information in this span of time, including writing the third of the 3 sea books called The Edge of the Sea in 1955. In 1957, unfortunately, one of her niece dies, and Rachel actually adopts her son.
Her great-nephew?
Her great-nephew.
Okay.
Raising him as her own while still caring for her ailing mother as well. Ugh. So she's just kind of has all of this bad luck in her regular life.
Yeah.
And then she is still doing all of this amazing stuff in her public life. Now, 1962 comes about, which is when she publishes Silent Spring. And Silent Spring, if you don't know, is essentially the book that spurred the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. It's what got DDT banned. Mm-hmm. It spurred the evolution of the environmental awareness campaigns and knowing the impact that we're doing on the world. She's quoted as saying, "It was not my contention that chemical insecticides must never be used. I do contend that we have put poisonous and biologically potent chemicals indiscriminately into the hands of persons largely or wholly ignorant of their potential for harm. Mm. We have subjected enormous numbers of people to contact with these poisons without their consent and often without their knowledge. And she wrote that in Silent Spring itself. Before the book came out, because they knew just how crazy the backlash to the book was going to be, they actually distributed chapters of the book to scientists all across the country so that they could vet it as much as they possibly could.
Right.
They also did that so that, because they were really concerned with charges of libel and suits, lawsuits for libel. So they also wanted to be able to say, no, every single thing that we're saying in this book, that I'm saying in this book, is scientifically sound and can hold up in a court of law. What's really interesting, and what I didn't know while this whole book was coming out, was that Silent Spring comes out in 1962. 1960, Rachel Carson had started finding lumps and had started finding, and they diagnosed her not only with a couple ulcers, but also a tumor as well. So the entire time that she's going through the publication and the press tour and the defense and the intense public backlash that came from Silent Spring, she's also battling cancer the entire time, going through radiation treatment. She only goes into remission for little spans of time. And she's caring for her ailing mother, and she's raising the son of her niece who had died like a couple years earlier, right? So if ever you feel like you can't get up and go to a march, or you can't get up and go vote, or you can't get up and drive someone to the polls, like, look at what Rachel Carson did, suffering all of the things that she suffered through, and say, I can do better, and I must do better. A couple of the main detractors who were against it. First was DuPont, which was a main manufacturer of DDT along with other chemicals. They compiled an extensive report on the book's press coverage and estimated impact on public opinion. Velsicol, which is another chemical creator who made chemicals also talked about in Silent Spring, threatened legal action against Houghton Mifflin, as well as the New Yorker and Audubon Society, because they were going to feature excerpts of the book in their pages. There was a biochemist named Robert White Stevens, who is very well known, who said, if man were to follow the teachings of Miss Carson, we would return to the Dark Ages, and the insects and diseases and vermin would once again inherit the earth. Others went further, attacking Carson's scientific credentials because her training was in, quote, marine biology as opposed to biochemistry. Some were attacking her personal character, some labeling her a fanatic defender of the cult of the balance of nature, whatever the hell that means.
You can't hear my eye roll, but it's happening.
Former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Ezra Taft Benson reportedly concluded that because she was unmarried, despite being physically attractive, she was probably a communist and shouldn't be listened to.
That's the most logical thing that I've heard in hours.
Literally.
What? Oh my God.
And so what's actually interesting is that all of the backlash that the chemical industry did against the book actually ended up hurting them in the long run, because it ended up publicizing and getting more people to hear about the book than anyone was going to in the first place.
Yeah, if you're not guilty, just shh.
Exactly.
Stay quiet.
Exactly. Methinks the chemical companies doth protest a little too much. Carson herself was even quoted as saying, yeah, my publisher could have, there's no way they could have paid for all of that publicity.
This, yeah, free marketing.
literally. Because of the reaction, CBS Reports put out a TV special called The Silent Spring of Rachel Carson. It spurred Congress to do a congressional review. It spurred President Kennedy to put out a review after he was asked a question about it at a news conference. And at one of her last public appearances, Carson testified before Congress on the Science Advisory Committee, which then largely backed up the claims made by Carson. So this is 1963. And then later that year, she receives a flurry of awards, the Audubon Medal from the Audubon Society, the Cullum Geographical Medal from the American Geographical Society, and the induction into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. And then a year later, cancer takes a turn for the worst, unfortunately. She goes in for liver treatment because they find that the cancer has spread to her liver. She gets a respiratory virus because her immune system is degraded.
Yeah.
And then, unfortunately, she had a heart attack on April 14th, 1964. One last honor for her. She was given the Presidential Medal of Freedom on June 9th, 1980, posthumously, by President Jimmy Carter. Honestly, one of the most influential women that we've covered.
Yeah, and it was so cool when you said that you were going to talk about her today. I remember growing up, because I was that kid that was always like in the library in the nonfiction section. I'm pretty sure I read every book in the Eva Perry Regional Library on the American Revolutionary War. And I remember asking my mom, like, who else can I read about? And she suggested Rachel Carson. And I think I read probably like 5 or 6 biographies, but like the kid ones, with all the pictures and stuff that are like, So I can't, it's like that thing where you just don't always think about how amazing women are always shaping the world. Even when they're really well known, you don't always know everything in their story.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So get ready for the ride of your life.
Okay. I'm strapped in.
All right. So the woman I'm talking about today has a name that has some sounds that don't really exist in English. So I have a couple varying pronunciations from other languages. So it can be translated into Chinese as Zhao Shi Zheng, in Korean as Cho or Jo Se Jung. So we're gonna go with what we can say.
Sure, absolutely.
Now, some sources say that this story actually happened in the year 43 AD.
Oh, jeez.
But it's more likely that it happened about 200 years later, because 43 AD is when the Chinese took control of Vietnam.
Oh, okay.
So 200 years down the line is really more likely when this story starts to take place. So we are just going to call her Zhao for simplicity as we go along.
Fair enough. I think that's fair.
So Zhao is probably more legend than fact, but there are some facts, and either way, it's a crazy legend. So some historical background before we get going. China is obviously a very large imperial power for a long time, and they had been in Vietnam for about 200 years by the year 220 AD. So even though it'd been so long, the Vietnamese were still like, nah, bro, we're not Chinese.
We're not used to this.
We're not cool with this. Right. So when the Han Dynasty collapsed that year, the Viet people attempted a rebellion, but they were very unorganized and easily crushed, and it didn't really go that well.
Okay.
So the Vietnamese ruling family was deposed and replaced by some guys who are a lot more friendly with the Chinese, a go figure.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently during this sort of re-siege, retaking of power by the Chinese, 10,000 Vietnamese people were killed.
Oh my God.
Which in the year 220 AD is probably like 8 villages. Like that's a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a lot.
So now bringing this back to Zhao, details of her early life are very uncertain, but it seems that her parents died when she was young and she was raised by her brother and her brother's wife, who was a horrible witch.
Oh.
Or just, you know, kind of mean.
Sure.
So there are certain accounts that say her family was pretty high ranking in the social system in Vietnam. But when Zhao was about 19, she killed her sister-in-law in a fight, ran away into a mountain, and spent the next several months training herself to become a fighter to help liberate the Vietnamese people from Chinese rule.
Okay.
Because that's what you do on a Tuesday.
Heck of a way to start the resistance.
Right. So word kind of started to get around that there was this badass warrior woman living in the mountains training to fight Chinese, and men started going up the mountain to join her.
Yes.
So she soon had the command of over 1,000 warriors who were eager to rid Vietnam of the Chinese. Now, her brother was pretty pissed off that Zhao had killed his wife, as you are. And he went up the mountain to confront her and tell her that what she was doing was not suitable for a woman and she should probably knock it off and get married. Boo on the brother, right? This is what she said in response. Quote, "I only want to ride the wind and walk the waves, slay the big whales of the Eastern Sea, clean up the frontiers, and save the people from drowning. Why should I imitate others, bow my head, stoop over, and be a slave?
Yes.
Why resign myself to menial housework?" End quote. And apparently her speech was so rousing, he decided to stay with her, join the army, and fight alongside her. Just forgave her for killing his wife.
Obviously, you found the right path, so I'm going to join you.
Yeah, you're right. So in the spring of 248 AD, roughly, Zhao and her warriors, they'd been training for the past 6 months. They stormed out of the jungle at the Chinese. She was on top of an elephant wielding 2 swords. And some say that the swords were already bloodied when she came out of the jungle. Who knows?
Oh my.
This attack came as a huge surprise to the Chinese forces, and Zhao and her army successfully overran them and drove them back.
Whoa.
So the family now in charge of running Vietnam sent word to China for help because the elephant riding sword wielding woman has burst out of the mountains and we are not prepared for this.
Is this Boudicca?
Right? So King Wu of China sent a bunch of warriors to take on Zhao, and she took them on a string of battles across the entirety of Southeast Asia. She earned the nickname the Lady General Clad in Golden Robe,
and
it's said that she fought in as many as 30 battles over the course of 6 months. She not only led guerrilla attacks like her first one, but also planned and launched full-scale assaults against protected cities. This had never been done before against the Chinese.
I bet.
Like, ever.
Yeah, no.
So, yeah, they were pretty surprised. Yeah. Now, her story obviously started to become a legend, and even though her story was written down only a few years after her death, it was still probably extremely exaggerating.
Mm-hmm.
For example, she was described as an otherworldly goddess of war who was incredibly beautiful, 9 feet tall, and had 3 breasts that were so huge she had to sling them over her shoulder while she was fighting. This is probably,
first of all,
not accurate.
That does not sound like an exaggeration. Three breasts that she would sling over her shoulders?
Yeah, because they were so large, because she was 9 feet tall.
God bless.
It's also said that her voice was as clear as a temple bell that could be heard over any battlefield. The Chinese would flee at the sight of her because it was easier to fight a tiger than face Lady Zhao in battle.
What a lady.
Now, there's one very far-fetched story that says she was very afraid of penises and that the Chinese army would run at her naked and it would freak her out and she wouldn't be able to handle it and run away.
What?
We're not so sure about that. Isn't that the weirdest defense? Like, you're a badass warrior woman. Look at my penis and be afraid.
Wait, so she rode an elephant while holding 2 swords into battle.
Yeah, and a tiny little penis going to freak her out. I am calling BS on that
I'm going to call a flag on that play.
Oh, man. So she led her army through the spring and summer of 248 AD. It was the most successful and widespread resistance to the Chinese occupation that Vietnam would ever undertake.
Uh-huh.
However, while her army was well-trained in fighting, they weren't equipped for siege warfare, and so they would frequently have to make camp and just kind of wait out the Chinese forces.
Oh, okay.
And some men grew bored and left. Some were bribed away by King Wu. Some left when the seasons changed because they had to go and plant food and live.
Farm.
So going into the fall, her armies lessened and became vulnerable. Eventually, she was attacked and defeated. Surrounded by the enemy, she drowned herself in a river instead of being taken captive.
She drowned herself
in a river.
That's...
She's not even going to take one of those swords and take the easy way out. It feels like there are
easier ways to go.
She's
going to
drown herself in the river. I just want to say it one more time. She drowned herself in a river. Okay? Do we understand? Now, the commander of the Chinese army, now that she was dead, was terrified that Lady Zhao was going to come back and haunt him in her death.
Oh, my God.
So he went crazy and ordered that 100 wooden penises be carved into the outside of his headquarters in order to frighten her away. I am not kidding you. I don't know why this is not a movie. It's the most amazing story I've read in a really long time.
Let me get this straight. This man was so afraid that the ghost...
Of her ghost. Not her alive.
That he had 100 penises attached...
Carved into the wood.
Into the wood of his...
Of his
offices,
cabin. Yep. Because the ghost would probably...
What's the word for that? Overcompensating?
Like, isn't this just the most insane? It's the most insane. Now, other Vietnamese revolutionaries years later said that Lady Zhao would materialize in their dreams to give them fighting advice and tips on how to fight guerrilla war against the Mongol invasion. One of these people was a Viet hero named Tran Hung Dao. Now, in the mid-15th century, the Vietnamese government attempted to write Zhao out of history. Confucianism had taken hold in society, and it was very anti-woman. Mm, they were attempting to clear all women from the history books. However, her legend is so huge, it survived this attempted purge.
They had those wooden penises
Yeah.
carved into the door.
Right, yeah. And this also probably explains that while in Chinese history books there is mention of a serious rebellion in Vietnam during this time, there's absolutely no mention of Lady Zhao. Mm-hmm. Now, another interesting observation is that Zhao took on the attributes of a goddess and otherworldly being during this time because it would be humiliating if a mortal woman had defeated so many men in battle. But, you know, if she's a goddess...
Oh my God.
Then they, it's better.
They deified her to lessen the shame of it.
Now, her legend re-emerged with strong force during the Vietnam War, of course, along with other legends and stories of warrior women of pre-Confucian culture, including the Trung sisters. And I'm going to circle back to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. And we probably should try and cover them later, too. Yes. Except their story does actually take place in like 43 AD.
Oh,
so even harder to get some real sources. 800 years later, there are several shrines that exist in her honor. There are streets in Vietnam named after her, and an elephant-riding warrior woman is considered one of the greatest national heroes in Vietnamese history. She's depicted on a bunch of artwork and even on a stamp. There is a national holiday that celebrates her bravery, and she is sometimes called today the Vietnamese Joan of Arc.
Wow.
Now, I just want to go back to the Trung sisters really quickly and read a quick quote from a 15th century poem about them that is also very applicable to the lady general clad in golden robe.
Yes.
Quote, "All the male heroes bowed their heads in submission. Only the two sisters proudly stood up to avenge the country."
Oh. What an amazing woman.
This story is everything. Like, every time I'm like, there are more badass women in history than we are ever told about or taught about, and we need more movies about them. And then you find the thing like this. It has everything. It's got like bravery, humor with the penises. We just need a love story. And it's almost
I'm sure there has to be one in there in a way.
It a little bit reminds me of Cinderella with her parents dying and then living with her brother and then like this evil stepmother, except Cinderella, you know, rises up and kills her stepmother and then raises a whole army to go fight the foreign invaders.
Cinderella doesn't have to wait for a prince to save her. She takes over the story herself. Exactly. Gets an elephant, two swords, and just terrifies everyone.
Isn't that incredible?
That's amazing. That is honestly one of the funniest reactions I've ever heard to a woman dying.
What? Oh, man. Hi friends, it's Allison here. Well, I'm not here. I'm actually in New Mexico filming my movie, Banging Lainey. And that movie is what gave birth to this podcast years ago. Max and I chatting about it, and I'm so, so excited that he has helped me so far. And you listeners have helped so much in making this movie happen. And that means 2 episodes this month. There's going to be some special guests with Max. And if you are enjoying this podcast, if you want to help more awesome movies happen made by women, supporting learning about women, all you need to do is go to patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. You get access to the contributors blog. I'll probably throw up some behind the scenes photo from our film there as well. Check it out. $1 a podcast, $2 a podcast, $10 a podcast. Can do it all at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. If you're not able to donate financially, I totally understand. I'm working for free for a month in New Mexico. But what you can do is just look down at your phone, your computer, your tablet, your Google Glass, whatever you're listening to this podcast on, and leave us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. I can't wait to come back and talk to you all in March. Thank you.
Shall we do a literally today in history?
I do want to do that. That was a terrible introduction. Yes, please. Leave it. It's gold.
Okay. We discussed earlier today that we should talk about
all of the women running for political office.
Yes.
I'm seeing so many headlines popping up about the record number of women running for office and also the record number of women being elected in local offices.
Absolutely.
And sort of in the smaller races that happen around the country, you know, fairly frequently because every state is different and communities. And I just want to talk about it because it's awesome.
Exactly. And, you know, we talked about this on Bitch With Me, I believe either last week or the episode before, where, you know, if you want to have an impact on the way government works, there's only two ways to do that. Either you vote, or you put your hat in the ring and you actually get in and you get a seat on the table. So just some statistics. This comes from the Time article that came out where they had all of the different women running for office, came out right before the Women's March. And this is a direct quote. There is an unprecedented surge of first-time female candidates running for offices big and small, from the U.S. Senate and state legislatures to local school boards. At least 79 women are exploring runs for governor in 2018, potentially doubling a record for female candidates set in 1994, according to the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. The number of Democratic women likely challenging incumbents in the U.S. House of Representatives is up nearly 350% from 41 in 2016. Roughly 900 women contacted Emily's List, which recruits and trains pro-choice Democratic women about running for office from 2015 to 2016. But this year, more than 26,000 women have reached out about launching campaign. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Emily's List had to knock down a wall in their campaign headquarters in D.C. to fit all of the extra staff that they need. So
break down the wall. Break down the wall. That's amazing.
So it just kind of underscores the moment that we're in. But let's talk about why it's important to run, why it's important to be in the room and to have a voice in politics.
Oh, man. Let's start with the easy questions. I think, even growing up, I would say I don't like politics. I don't understand politics because it's such a vast, complicated beast. And I often feel when I'm listening to the news, it's almost like trying to start Lost in season 3.
Yeah, that's like, fair.
You need to have so much backstory and like have been listening to the news 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Especially with things, you know, with China and the Middle East, like there's a lot of world history to catch up on.
Absolutely.
But what I think it really boils down to is realizing that you can't be intimidated by having to ask a question. Mm-hmm. And being involved and being part of the process, you can only help. Even if you just only learn for yourself and understand the system, that's how you're going to make change. You have to change the system from inside the system.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, at a certain point, like if you do decide to start Lost in the middle of the third season, like you can go back and research and find where everything else is. You know, one of the examples I use is, so, you know, I sit on the neighborhood council, right, in Los Angeles. And the neighborhood council, it is an elected position, but it's not a decision-making body.
Right.
Instead, what we do is we make recommendations to the city council, the LA Planning Commission, Department of Building Safety, the different councilman offices. We make recommendations to all these people. And a lot of times, you'll find that if you look at your local politics, if you look at what's happening in your cities and your towns, you'll find these bodies that are easy to run for. A lot of times, the offices are completely vacant. For example, when I ran for my office, there was no one sitting there. And I showed up, and I'm not even joking. I was elected to my position with 2 votes.
Wow.
2 votes. And that's all it takes to show up and to start having a vote.
That's why there weren't 3.
Exactly. So right. Exactly.
I don't live in your neighborhood.
But that's what it is. You know, one of my favorite sayings is to say decisions are made by those who show up. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, you know, the people high up, the governors, your senators and your representatives, those people who feel like they're out of touch or out of the ability for you to actually talk to, a lot of times there are lower government levels or lower positions that you can run for and get involved with, or advisory councils that you can get appointed to that have a profound impact on legislation, not only at the grassroots level, but also the city, the state, and the federal level as well.
Yeah. And I'm realizing what I was going towards saying and then totally lost my train of thought, if you couldn't tell, was I think for me, something that is currently semi-disheartening in national politics, but I think at the local level, we see much more of it, is compromise. Like I was a nanny for 16 years. If I know about conflict resolution, I know about conflict resolution. Okay. I can sit 2 kids down and we are going to talk out our feelings. And we are going to come to an agreement that we're all going to be happy with. Or people are going to go in their rooms for a timeout. You know, sometimes you can't win them all, and that's fine.
Right.
And so I think knowing that you can have that impact and that everyone at the table has a voice and has a right to be heard, mm-hmm. being part of that discussion and helping to lead and guide that discussion at a local level, to me right now, is even more important than nationally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really goes to show you, if you look at the situation we find ourselves in now, mm-hmm. in our political system, where essentially you have a group that represents a minority of the country mm-hmm. making decisions for
the majority
of mm-hmm. the country. And a lot of this has its roots in, well, one, a lady that I'm going to be talking about next week, Phyllis Schlafly, uh-huh. Who was one woman who found herself a platform, who started, you know, a movement, yeah. essentially. And sometimes it does take just one person or a couple people getting together and saying, I don't like this, or I'm going to ask questions. You know, you said right at the beginning of this conversation, you know, all you can do is help. And sometimes what I've found in that, as a new person, a lot of times you end up asking the questions and noticing things that the people who have been there forever mm-hmm. just take as fact, just take right. as rote, just take as the way things have always been done.
Right.
And you, as a new person, can be like,
but do they have to be done that way?
Do they have to be done that way? Exactly.
I think, and I'm very hopeful, that we have another giant wave of feminism happening yeah. at the moment. Yeah. And women are just sick and tired of people thinking that we're just going to freak out at your penis and run away. Because we're not.
Right. Yeah.
We're not.
Absolutely.
There's just like... there is systemic racism in this mm-hmm. country. There is systemic sexism in this country and in a lot of cultures around the world. And we're just not going to take it anymore.
Yeah.
Like, we're not giving up our seat on the bus.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I can co-opt a moment.
Absolutely. You know, what's really interesting about what we're seeing now is, like, for the first time in recorded human history, for the most part, you're seeing a major world power mm-hmm. where the women of that culture are starting to say, we are going to dictate our lives. We are going to yeah. be completely equal citizens in society. And if you're not willing to give that to us, we're going to take it.
Yeah.
And we're not going to take it any other way.
Time's up.
Literally, time is up.
Now, Max gave me a sweater, and he has a matching one. Sweatshirt, I suppose. You may have seen pictures of either of us wearing it on Facebook or yep. together. And it says, a woman's place is in the House and the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And not this past Christmas, but the Christmas before. So Christmas 2016.
Mm-hmm.
I was wearing it in Santa Barbara at the train station, waiting to take the train back to LA. And this man said something, I forget, like, oh, I want to read your sweatshirt. And at mm-hmm. first I was like, oh, I don't want to deal with you right now. Like, mm-hmm. what are you going to say against my sweatshirt? And he goes, my daughter wants to run for president one day. Can she take a picture with you?
Oh, God.
Because she, like, yeah. loved my sweater so yeah. much. And she was just this little 10-year-old girl. And my best friend Beverly and I were there together. And we were both like, run for president. Yeah. Do it. Do you see my sweater? This can happen.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I think we're just seeing a shift, and I yeah. hope that it really yeah. changes things and that it continues.
Agreed. Agreed.
So for our cause of the week, we're going to do Emily's List,
yes.
which seems very fitting.
Mm-hmm.
Their vision is to balance the voice of power. Our vision is a government that reflects the people it serves and the decision makers who genuinely and enthusiastically fight for greater opportunity and better lives for the Americans they represent. We will work for larger leadership roles for pro-choice Democratic women in our legislative bodies and executive seats so that our families can benefit from the open-minded, productive contributions that women have consistently made in office. And may I just say, to wrap that up, Emily's List, if you go back to any of our previous seasons and listen to any episode about almost any woman mm-hmm. in a seat of power, whether that power is political or more often born into queens and
right.
pharaohesses. Female pharaohs.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most bestest time in their country ever yeah. for the arts yeah. and the culture and the economy and the everything. Mm-hmm. Like, the numbers and the history don't lie.
Nope. Nope. You can find them at emilyslist.org. Well, that wraps it up for another episode of The Bitchery of History. If you'd like to keep in contact with us, you can do that on Twitter at Bitchery Podcast.
Instagram at The Bitchery of History.
On Facebook, just search The Bitchery of History.
And join our discussion group there as well. I am constantly posting articles in there.
Yes. You can also find our website at umpboh.com. If you've got suggestions for women we should cover, suggestions for lady bits, you want to leave us a comment, you want to get in touch with us, there's a submission form there as well. It comes right to my phone, right to my email address.
As always, we could not make this show happen by ourselves. Mm-hmm. So thank you to Jeanette,
Sydney,
Kim,
and Jess.
And as always,
bitches get stuff done.